Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Host at 7 o'clock right now on This Day in History, the 22nd of October. Back in 1906, a gentleman by the name of Henry Ford became the president of the Ford Motor Company. I wonder who was president before that. 1924 on this day, the Toastmasters International Organization was founded. In 1962 on this day, John F. Kennedy would kick off what we would today know as the Cuban Missile Crisis, announcing a naval blockade against Cuba. In 1981 on this day, the U.S.'s debt would topple $1 trillion. Interestingly enough, today it stands 34 times higher than that. 1991 on this day, Japan would decide to lift the sanctions it had imposed on South Africa. In 2000 on this day, Michael Schumacher would begin the first of his five straight consecutive title victories or championship victories by beating Mika Hakkinen in the Drivers' Championship race. 2006 on this day, Fernando Alonso would beat Michael Schumacher to win his second title. In 2008, Google Play was launched on this day, and in 2016 a company called AT&T would buy another company called Time Warner for $85.4 billion. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we are taking a look at a new benchmark that's being put in place by the South African Reserve Bank and other organizations in an effort to mitigate what could be seen as manipulation between the banking rates, or the rate at which banks loan to themselves. It all gets very complicated, but we're going to try and simplify it. We've got a conversation with Treasury One's director, Andre Silius, around that. We've also got a conversation with Momentum Wealth around the annuities conversation that we had a little while ago with them. Last time we spoke to them, we looked at guaranteed annuities. This time we're going to be taking a look at the right time to buy an annuity and the value of timing that purchase correctly. Then we've got a conversation with the team at Food and Trees for Africa, the nonprofit organization, as part of our Agri Tuesdays, on the concept of urban farming. Certainly an interesting concept. They've got a project that's currently taking place in Johannesburg near Southgate Mall, and we're going to be taking a look at projects like that and trying to understand the value of urban farming in our environment. And then, because we have a couple of news updates from SARS, we're going to see if we can speak to the South African Revenue Services themselves. Might be a bit tricky. SARS is a very busy organization. They've come out with a statement around the fuel, the diesel depots that they have been raiding as part of their clampdown on a black market diesel, but also updates on their revenue collections. If we can get hold of them before the end of the show, we'll definitely speak to them.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're going to kick things off, as we usually do, with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. And joining me to take a look at these market movements and try and understand what's been happening is Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantel Marks. Good evening, Chantel. Lovely to speak to you, as always. It seems like we can't get our minds made up. And by we, I mean the markets. We had a really good week last week, today, and this week. We've started off the week in negative territory, but commodities are doing well, but equities aren't. Everything's all a mess.
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at the market today, it actually didn't look too bad towards the close. So we had a very tough open, definitely some downward pressure there. But it looks like our market wants to push higher. I think what we're just lacking at the moment is a catalyst. And obviously, we're in an environment where there's a lot going on from a risk perspective. Geopolitical risk, we have politics in the US that still need to play out. And the impact on markets there, I think, is a big question mark as well. And as we know, if it's volatile in the US and it's volatile globally, investors tend to stay away from emerging markets to a certain extent, and we're just a casualty of that.
Chantel, how do we find that catalyst? Because we've speculated about this for a number of weeks. We've sat down, we've spoken about this, and we've even tried to kind of uncover what undervalued markets might look like or where the value might be. What kind of catalyst are we waiting for? Because I imagine the only real event that's outstanding for this year is that US election. We've gone through interest rate conversations. We're starting that interest rate cutting cycle. Inflation is kind of hopefully behind us, not going to say it too many times, but what kind of catalyst are we looking for here?
So I think from a global markets perspective, the some certainty on the political front, I think, would be great, particularly as it relates to the US. And then from a South African market perspective, I think the biggest catalyst that we are missing out on, or that we're missing at the moment, is some decent flows from foreign investors. We've already started seeing local investors getting back into the South African market, becoming more interested in local stocks. We've seen SA Inc. push higher a little bit. Well, not a little bit, a lot of it, but it can still go higher. Those valuations are still depressed. So what we need is some foreign flows. And then I think what we also need from a South African perspective is some solid gains on the commodities front. So we have had a period of very weak industrial metal prices. And I do think that if we start seeing that cycle turns, which I guess is going to be a function of the Chinese growth story and perhaps more confidence from a global markets perspective, then I think it could be really, really positive for us.
Chantal, what do we do if we don't see that? What's the plan B here? I'm thinking about the fact that, as you said, our local guys have put in what they've put in into the market, into getting the market restarted. And obviously, a lot of it still rests on the reforms that we need to see. We need to have South Africa be more attractive to those international investors. And that includes everything from transport and logistics and things with our SOEs, right down to getting off a grey list and all of those sorts of factors that are still up in the air are possibly what's holding sentiment back. What happens if those are still delayed? How do we realize the momentum and not fall behind?
So I think your plan B is just what should have been your plan A all along. You look at companies that have quality management teams that can grow in any economic circumstance, and we've had evidence of that over the last few years. You look at companies that generate high and growing cash flows and that have a solid history of executing on strategy and investing capital and getting decent returns on it. So that strategy, I think, remains in place. The only difference would be you probably won't get kind of super normal returns from these companies. It'll be more or less what we saw in the past. So if the company's quality, it will deliver the returns. And I think when there's uncertainty around, your best thing to do is to look for opportunities at acquiring some of those companies at decent valuations. Because if things go in our favor, you might not get that opportunity again anytime soon.
Identify the quality companies. Is We Buy Cars one of those quality companies? They gave us a trading update today, and it's for the full year ended September, and I suspect this is going to be the first time, I think it is, yes, we listed this year, so this will be the first set of complete numbers for a financial year. What did the trading update provide us with in terms of insights and clarity?
So they said that core headline earnings are expected to increase by between 21 and 26%, so call about 23.5% at the midpoint, which I think is really, really solid. Headline earnings per share expected to grow slower, but that's because they issued new shares when they listed. So that's not really something that I would be overly concerned about. The 23.5% is basically the momentum that they have in profitability in that business. And that is huge, particularly if you consider the very difficult trading environment that we've had over the last year or so. I mean, things have started to feel better more recently, but the reality is that interest rates have been very high, inflation has been high, disposable income hasn't been great, confidence has slowly improved, but not at a level where people feel comfortable going out and making big ticket purchases like a vehicle. But We Buy Cars continues to gain market share, and they're executing really well on their plans. And from what management said at the listing, there's still a lot more to come here. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the full set of results, looking at the nitty-gritty, looking at those cash flow numbers and how they're able to to generate cash flow based on that revenue and profitability that we're talking about. I think the valuation still looks okay. And yeah, I mean, this is a company that I think I'm very excited about over the medium to long term.
Chantal, I want to quickly glance at transaction capital while we're looking at We Buy Cars. Obviously, the relationship between the two has been intertwined for the longest time. And following that unbundling, we kind of saw transaction capital come and settle around that 3 rand 60, 3 rand 50 mark. We're below 3 rand a share at the moment. How are we feeling about that particular stock? I mean, since that unbundling, the share price has really struggled to even come back above 3 rand.
Yes, and I think that that speaks to the trust deficit that management has with shareholders, or shareholders have with management. I mean, the implosion of SA Taxi really caught so many investors off guard, and the fallout of that has been very, very significant. So I think even though the stock is undervalued, even though they have started the process of divesting from SA Taxi and are going to rebrand as Newton, and Newton is a business where we see growth possibly going forward, it's just that the name is a little bit tainted now. So I think it'll take a while for them to gain the trust of shareholders again and actually breach that. I think you probably have a fair value of about 5 or 6 rand on the stock, but trading at 3 rand, and I don't see it getting meaningfully higher than that in the near term.
They still have their work cut out for them. Chantal, let's look at Sasol quickly. They put out a production statement for the 3 months ended September. Anything surprise you there?
Not at all. What was surprising was how surprised the market was by this business update. I mean, we know chemical prices are under pressure, so margins are under pressure there. We know the rand is stronger, and that isn't great for Sasol. We know that they've had issues with coal quality and their mining business. So none of this is actually new news. I think that the market is just so over Sasol and how weak it's been operationally and how poor the share price has been, and momentum is downwards and sentiment is downbeat, that when they put out something that's, I mean, even though it's expected, is a little bit negative, the stock just gets beaten down. So I'm still staying away from this one. I think you can there's a place for it and there will be opportunities, but yeah, for now that momentum is just so negative.
At what point do we stop beating down on a stock like Sasol? And I ask this only because I'm looking at the share price. We're back at September 2020 levels, effectively undoing the last 4 years of price movement to the upside. So you're getting in at a four-year discount, effectively. We can potentially go lower, but any lower than this, and I'm seeing this as the big oil crash of the start of the pandemic. Can we realistically say that there's still further downside on the Sasol share price, or is this kind of getting to as low as it can be?
So I think that what Sasol really needs is for chemical prices to recover meaningfully so that they can recover some margin there. They need oil prices to stabilize and perhaps push higher a little bit. And then they need better operational execution. So I think if you get that combo, or you start seeing the beginnings of that combo actually playing out, that will be quite positive for them. So what do we need? We need higher economic growth. We need certainty around oil supply and demand, which we don't have at the moment, given what's going on in the Middle East and with the lack of demand perceived demand that's coming through from China. And then operationally, things just haven't been moving smoothly. So I think that once you start seeing them bringing out updates that don't have the same downbeat tone, and where you can actually start seeing go forward momentum for Sasol, the market will start getting interested again. And perhaps then at some point the stars will align for Sasol. But this is a cyclical company, Jimmy. So people need to understand that. It's not one that you hold and it just keeps on going higher and higher. There'll be times when it behaves like it's behaving now, but of course the flip side is also true.
Chantal, let's wrap things up with a company that's less cyclical, but that has also been in the news lately, Sasfin. They gave us their numbers for the financial year. I don't know if you got a chance to take a look at those audited numbers. It does look like we kind of were being prepared for this leading up to these numbers. But still, for group headline earnings to be down more than 100%, all of those numbers, profits down as well quite significantly. What do we make of these numbers, and does it just reaffirm the conversations that have been happening that we're likely to see Sasfin delisting sometime soon?
Yes, so I've had a quick glance at these numbers, and it doesn't make for pretty reading. And I think that actually gives a firm case for why this company should delist. I mean, it's had a lot of negative press for various reasons over the last few years. And perhaps it's better for them to kind of right the ship in an unlisted environment, and for shareholders to at least realize something from their ownership of Sasfin shares. I think I'm not saying that they can't turn the story around in a listed environment, but I think that it's probably just a better idea to move away from the limelight a little bit while they try and figure out a way forward.
Lots to think about, lots to reflect on, and lots of decisions for companies to make, but we'll keep an eye on these and hopefully we can see some form of positive movements as we wrap up the year. We definitely want to be ending the year on a high, but we'll have to end this conversation here for now because we've run out of time. Thank you so much, as always, Chantel, for the time and for the insights. Chantel Marks, Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, on the market movements as well as some company news and what could potentially be driving sentiment going forward.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Many of us might not realize this or might not even know that it's been happening, but there has been a group that's been meeting for the last couple of years. In fact, they've been meeting for the last 6 years in an effort to reorganize how the South African interest rate landscape looks. That group is known as the Market Practitioners Group, comprising of both the public and the private sector, which is led by organizations like the South African Reserve Bank and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. And in a nutshell, what's happening here is we've decided we're moving from one interest rate measurement style to another one to become more universally or more globally attractive or globally competitive. And we're going to be taking a look at this because this has some serious implications for what we know as transactions and the funding rates on transactions as we know it. And I'm joined on the line by a Treasury Specialist and Director at Treasury One, Andre Siliers, to take a look at this and try and see if we can understand what's going on here. Good evening, Andre. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of a simplified background. This Market Practitioners Group sat down about 6 years ago or so in 2018 to chart out a new way forward on how things are going to be done, and a new benchmark was set to be put together. Fast forward 6 years, we've gone through some testing and all of that. Why was this started? What was envisioned here?
So interesting. Good evening to all the listeners. If we go back a number of years, then some people might recall that there was manipulation of interest rates, specifically the LIBOR rate in the United Kingdom and from other parts of the world. And quite a few banks were encountered heavy fines imposed on them, and that's where everything changed. Now, locally, we didn't have the LIBOR rate. That was more something to do with the dollar, but we have something called the JIBAR rate. The JIBAR rate was used for a benchmark fixing rate against a lot of instruments like interest rate swaps. There were even loans to people that was fixed against the JIBAR rate. And that's now the rate that's going to be replaced.
Now, the JIBAR rate, Andre, is the Johannesburg Interbank Average Rate. What's changing about this rate?
So the JIBAR rate is put together by what they would refer to as a benchmark rate for interbank lending between banks, but it is forward-looking, and it is then predicted by professionals, so-called professionals that's involved in the markets, and they would anticipate that the JIBAR rate could be X, and then that got fixed every day. But it was future-looking, and it was not based on any actual transactions. So it was an expert opinion of where money would be lent between banks, future looking, not actual transactions that it was based on.
So now the new rate that's set to be introduced, or the new method of measurement that we finally seemingly have settled on, is something known as ZARONIA, which is the South African Overnight Index Average. How is that different?
Okay, so that is completely different in the sense that it's backward looking. So it's based on actual transactions that took place between banks prior to the fixing of it. So if I use an example, if one bank were to lend money to another bank at 7% tonight, and another bank would be lending to another other bank money at 7.15% and so forth, then you would take backward looking all these transactions and calculate an average rate at which money was lent between banks. So it is based on actual transactions that took place prior to the fixing of right. And therein lies the big difference. The one is backward looking, the ZARONIA is backward looking based on actual transactions, whilst the JIBAR is an expert of opinion of where it could be that I will be lending money. So now you can clearly see that the one, because it actually happened, is not open to any manipulation, whilst the expert looking forward does lead it to be somewhat open to some manipulation.
I imagine, Andre, this is largely driven by the need for greater transparency and openness in these sorts of engagements, given what's happened in the past and given that we kind of want to be more globally competitive. Does this have anything to do with the fact that we have previously been grey-listed? Is this one of those tick boxes that we can mark off and say we've reformed this particular structure and we are looking to move forward with it?
I want to say that this has got very little to do with grey listing. This has got more to do with transparency of how rates are fixed and not really anything to do with grey listing. Mm. And this is just making the financial markets far more transparent and far more professional and not open to any manipulation of all sorts. Now, you would recall that not so long ago, we had discussions about manipulation of exchange rates that took place. Mm. So getting rid of all these possibilities of manipulation to something that is based on actual transactions and that is justifiable and cannot be manipulated is where we are moving. Far more professional.
Improving accuracy, there's nothing wrong with that side of it. Andre, before I let you go, what are the implications, if any, for you and I as everyday consumers, as clients, those that engage with these banks? Obviously, we are involved at somewhere in the food chain. I just want to get a sense of what the implications are for us.
It could have a very small impact in the cost of financing. So where this rate is used to benchmark the cost of financing a loan or an interest rate swap or any other derivative, it could impact on the cost of that. And it could not necessarily impact negatively, it could even impact positively. But it would be very, very small, because I do not believe that there was any big manipulation in the fixing of JIBAR ever. So it would have a very small impact, if any, but it would just make things more transparent and professional.
So it's aligning us with global standards, making things more transparent and professional. I think that's always a good thing, especially when we look at the efforts that are being put in to make us more globally competitive and more open towards investments and towards business. I think we'll leave it at that. Andre, thanks so much for the insights and for the time. That was Andre Celiers, who is a director at Treasury One, on the changing interbank rates and how that will all work when it comes into effect.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Ready to take control of your financial future? Moneyversity Plus is your go-to streaming edutainment platform for all ages. With fun, engaging content and downloads for kids ages 6 to 17 and practical lessons for adults of all ages, Moneyversity Plus makes learning about money easy and exciting for everyone in the family. Plus, as you learn, you can earn Old Mutual Rewards points, a win for your wallet and a win for your future. Whether it's mastering money basics or planning your financial goals, Moneyversity has you covered. Start streaming today and join thousands of others at moneyversity.co.za. Your plus one for financial wisdom.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by Momentum Wealth. A couple of weeks ago, we had a conversation around guaranteed annuities with Momentum Wealth as a potential retirement or investment product that you would consider if you wanted to look at a more guaranteed income stream. We're continuing that conversation and we're building on that conversation, and we're taking a look at some other factors around annuities and understanding these products in greater detail. I'm once again joined on the line by the CEO for Structured Products and Annuities at Momentum Wealth, Faria Adam, to take a look at this and try and see if we can understand it. Good evening, Faria. Thanks so much for taking the time. The last conversation that we had a very detailed kind of chat around what guaranteed annuities are broadly and how they could potentially fit into someone's financial planning and their life planning. Let's just start our conversation with a recap on that, looking at guaranteed income streams and how we can basically secure the financial plan in the future through guaranteed income streams.
Hello, everyone. So the main purpose of a guaranteed annuity is really to convert a lump sum into an income stream. And we talk about guaranteed annuities really because that's what they are. The insurer takes all the risk of market volatility, not only now, but actually for the entire term of the contract, which usually is your life. And this means that we provide a lot of certainty to clients because you don't have the risk of running out of money during your lifetime and therefore becoming dependent on others. And this differs very much from your market-linked type of products, for example, living annuities, where the client takes on the risk of market volatility, and savings can drop during market downturns. So this means that clients have to take on the responsibility of managing their drawdown rate to make their savings last. And there's also the risk that they run out of money before they die. And the life annuity is therefore the contrary to this. So the life annuity provides the guaranteed income for as long as a client is alive.
Faria, let's look at annuities. I mean, we looked at guaranteed annuities in particular, but let's look at some of the factors that individual would need to think about when wanting to purchase an annuity. Obviously, there are different types of annuities, and we've spoken about this as well, to say it's not only guaranteed annuities out there, but what are the factors that I as an investor need to think about when deciding to purchase an annuity, especially before getting into that purchase?
Okay, so the most important thing to consider, to remember, is that you have to take into account your personal circumstances. So, for example, you need to understand what is your minimum income that you need to get every month. I think that's the first important thing. Then your own personal circumstances. So are you trying to cater just for an income for yourself for life, or do you want to cater for yourself and your life partner? In which case, you would perhaps purchase a joint life annuity that pays for as long as either one of you are alive. Another factor to think about is what we call a minimum guarantee term. So that's the minimum period for which you will receive the income, whether or not you are alive. So let's say, for example, I choose a guarantee term of 15 years. It means that that income will come to me for as long as I live, but for at least a period of 15 years. So those are some of the parameters that you need to think about. One of the most critical factors is really how your income increases. So when you have a starting, when you choose what we call a level annuity, it means that you lock into an income level that stays the same for the whole of your life, right? Now, it may look quite attractive initially, but you also have to consider how does that keep pace with inflation and how does the real value of that enable you in later years of your life? Because this could be an income that you receive for 20, 30 years to come still. So you also have to consider what kind of increases do you want to lock into? That could be, for example, 5% every year, or you could lock into CPI increases every year. And all of these things have an impact on the income that you receive in the first year. So you need to understand your personal circumstances very well, and then you need to find an income profile that best suits your personal needs.
Speaking of those personal needs, Faria, how do I know that an annuity product is the right product for me? Because there are so many investment products out there that you almost feel overwhelmed as an investor around, is this the most suitable product for me? Is this the one that's going to give me the most benefit when I think about my retirement? How do I know that this is the right product?
So what is important to understand is that these guaranteed annuities offer certainty. Okay, so there's no risk, there's no ups and downs. So it's a very good match for what we call life expenses. So all of us know there's certain expenses that we can't afford not to meet, whether it's and at retirement, that's even more critical. For example, your medical aid or your rent or your grocery bills. So that type of certainty and is actually so critical that it's very important to consider a guaranteed annuity type of solution for that. So that's almost the first thing to consider. The next thing is to consider, do you have the appetite almost for market volatility? Right. And the third thing is to actually just look at what kind of income can you get. Now, over the last few years, almost really since COVID, we've seen quite an increase in interest rates. And that's had a knock-on impact in long-term bond yields, where the yields available on long-term bonds have also increased. And that influences the return that you can actually lock into. For example, over 2024, let's say from January to now, the average rate on a male age 60 level income has been roughly 11.8%. That means that in the first year and every year thereafter, the client actually gets 11.8% of his purchase sum for as long as he lives. Now, you need to consider this level of drawdown against what is actually possible on market-linked assets. Another example, because I mentioned the inflation risk earlier, is to look at what would happen if you were to get an income that increases at 5% a year. Now, your starting income would be lower. It's the average over 2024 was around 7.5%. But which is less than the 10% we started with, but 7.5% increasing at a rate of 5% every year. After 10 years, you're already receiving 12% of your original investment amount every year. Now, that level of certainty of knowing exactly what you're going to get and being able to be sure that you don't have to worry what markets do over the longer term, you will receive that income, is actually a very appealing proposition.
Faria, you touch on the performance of these products and the kind of the return profile around the products. And I wonder, when we look at those products, how is that stacking up against perhaps other products in the market? So we've established that having the annuities in place is a very good idea for that stable and consistent income. But how are the annuity products from a product perspective performing in the market?
So they're performing actually very, very well. But obviously, markets go up and down. And when you invest for retirement, either pre-retirement saving or as we're talking now for retirement income, you're actually investing for quite a long time. So it's not going to be the same every year. You go through market cycles where things go up and things go down, right? What is important is to consider whether or not, in some instances, when you're really risk averse and you actually want to lock into a clear outcome for the rest of your life, then you lock in with all of your income. You actually have all of your income coming from a guaranteed annuity. The alternative is really having 100% invested in a market-linked asset, so in the industry these are called living annuities, not life annuities. But the third option is really a blend of the two, is to try to find the most optimal balance between having some certainty for your guaranteed for your life expenses, and then having some exposure to the market for what flexibility you want. And these are hybrid, what we call hybrid type of products. It's living annuity products that actually allow you to invest a portion of your money into a guaranteed life annuity so that you can try to find the optimal balance between the two and ensure that through the market cycles, you are protected.
Protecting yourself through the market cycles is so important. I think the next conversation we have, we should probably look at this joint life annuity concept, because that could be a benefit for households looking to secure income for both parties. But we've run out of time. That's going to be where we have to leave this particular conversation. Thank you, Faria, so much for the time and for the insights. That's Faria Adam, who is the CEO for Structured Products and Annuities at Momentum Wealth, on understanding annuities and whether or not they're right for you. This interview was brought to you by Momentum Wealth. Momentum Wealth guaranteed annuities offer you personalized control through certainty.
My love, everything's on track for our retirement, right?
I think we'll be fine.
You think?
Yep, I'm 100% certain. I think we'll be fine. Maybe, for sure, probably, but definitely, possibly, beyond the shadow of a doubt.
I think doesn't belong in a retirement plan. Momentum Wealth Annuities provide a guaranteed income so you can stop guessing and start knowing. Momentum Wealth Annuities, for financial decisions built on certainty. Ask your financial advisor today. Momentum Wealth is part of Momentum Metropolitan Life Limited, an authorized financial services and credit provider.
There's an eerie feeling of calm before the storm in the crypto market. This is among the longest periods where Bitcoin has remained range-bound for so long. My name is Shivan Woodley. I'm the macro strategist at 88, and I will be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where I'll give my prediction on what is likely to happen next in the crypto market.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with Ketso Gordon, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the South African SME Fund. Among the topics of conversation, why small businesses need to be paid in 30 days, the art of blended financing, and why scalability is not necessarily important in small businesses.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Experience award-winning private higher education. Experience EduVos. Kickstart your academic journey in humanities, commerce, law, applied science, or IT. Choose to study online, distance, or at their 12 campuses nationwide. There's still time to start your studies. Enroll for 30 September. Visit eduvos.com. EduVos, your education, your future.
The Property Pod.
If you have bought or sold a property, you will have dealt with the deeds office through your conveyancing attorneys. The Deeds Office is a key part of established property rights in South Africa. On the Property Pod this week, we chat with Kirsty D'Souza, a real estate lawyer at Cliff Decker Hofmeyer, about the significance and role of the Deeds Office.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
So around August of last year, there was an interesting article that was put out, or there were interesting developments in the fuel space. There was a fuel theft syndicate that was seemingly going on, and part of that was, or part of that involved the theft of some fuel tankers, and drivers were being looked for. And interestingly enough, the parties involved at that time, Alliance Fuels, were the victims of this theft from a fuel perspective. Now it seems exactly a year later, the tables have turned, and the South African Revenue Services has gone after Alliance Fuels for what they deem to potentially be the violation of the Customs and Excise Act. Now, that has some serious implications to the extent that the South African Revenue Services has gone after two of Alliance Fuel's facilities and shut down those facilities because they believe that the team at Alliance Fuels has been altering the diesel composition of the diesel they've been supplying into the market. These are very, very serious allegations, and for the South African Revenue Services to be involved definitely says something else. I have the privilege of speaking to the SARS commissioner on this and other matters. I'm joined on the line by Commissioner Edward Kiesvetter to take a look at these developments and try and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Commissioner. Thank you so much for the time. These are very serious allegations around the violations of Customs and Excise, or the violations of the Customs and Excise Act, and these are not violations that you take lightly as the receiver. Can you just take us through the decision to investigate these depots, or investigate the company and subsequently close down these depots?
So thank you for that, Jimmy. The first issue is that we have seen, because of the performance at our refineries, that we South Africa consumes about 79 million liters of refined fuel a day, and our refineries are not actively producing refined fuel. And this has led to a few things. Firstly, it has led to a higher level of imports of refined fuel. This would not be bad in itself, but when questionable operators then bring illicit fuel, don't declare it as fuel to try and have a to avoid the duties that that are payable on it, they are breaking the law. The second phenomena is they then take this paraffin that they bring in and they mix it with diesel. And there's a real reason for that. There's an arbitrage opportunity because paraffin, because it is household consumed, it is largely used for heating and cooking within households, has a lower tax duty payable on it as opposed to diesel, which is typically used for industrial purposes, for machinery, for automotives, etc. And so by blending diesel with paraffin, you are lowering the cost because you are saving on the tax. And then you're selling it as diesel. And so this is blatant tax evasion by using a illegal activity. All of these entities are supposed to be licensed, and we also find an abuse of licensing and regulatory conditions. The third issue for me on this, it's beyond just the tax evasion. There's an environmental consideration, because if an engine or a machine is designed to use diesel, and you mix it with paraffin, actually you have a higher emission level, and therefore this is negative for the environmental impact. And then lastly, there's a quality and safety consideration, because if you mix two fuels with different combustion rates, actually you can damage your machines, you introduce safety risks, and definitely a cost risk for those who consistently use mixed fuels in their machinery. And so it's a big issue for us. We work with the DME, we work with the regulator to help detect. We have our own tactical analysis and investigative unit, and we will continue to work with the investigative and prosecuting authorities to bring these illegal operations and entities to book.
Now, these are obviously very serious concerns, not only for SARS, but as you mentioned, Commissioner, for the country at large, and they have serious implications. Otherwise, we wouldn't be pursuing these matters so earnestly. I had a look at the reports, at least from the preliminary findings by SARS around just the value of what we're dealing with here. Inflows just shy of 9 billion rand, that being from this company alone that's being investigated. This is clearly potentially part of a wider problem that could pose some serious concerns around, as you said, tax fraud and tax evasion.
So we have already identified 38 entities who are dealing in these questionable practices that we are currently investigating. We believe that the tax duties that are prejudiced is around 8 billion. And we've already raised 8 billion in terms of additional schedules. We have recovered 2 billion already as we speak. And so, yes, this is a problem that we think we are touching the surface. And as we improve our tactical analysis and investigation, we think that over the next few months, we will report a proliferation of these entities. And as I said, one of the root causes is also, sadly, that we have fallen so far behind in our refinery production capability that has given rise to these illicit and illegal activities.
Well, these activities will certainly be put to an end, whether now or later, and those perpetrating these acts will be brought to book. Thank you, Commissioner, for those insights. We wish your team the best of luck in this. That was Commissioner of the South African Revenue Services, Edward Kiswetta, on the diesel black market and what SARS is doing to clamp down on that.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Agri Tuesday, and this week we're taking a look at a unique concept that seems to be growing in popularity, and that is urban farming. We're going to take a look at how it differs from traditional farming and what potential benefits it could have for the communities that get involved. I'm joined on the line by Robin Heels, who is the head of programs at Food and Trees for Africa, to take a look at this and try and understand it. Good evening, Robin. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an understanding of urban farming and its potential benefits.
Thanks for having me on, Jimmy. And that's a great question. You know, there are so many benefits of diversifying our food system. And farming vegetables organically in urban areas allows us to bridge that gap in the supply chain, making sure that nutritious organic vegetables are accessible by communities in under-resourced areas. And that's just one benefit. Other benefits include biodiversity that we include in all of our farms at Food and Trees for Africa, because we put in fruit trees and herbs, support plants and companions. And that also helps with soil health, which is really a sustainable resource management tool. And agroecology is the method in which we make all of this possible.
You mentioned soil health, Robin, and that was something I was wondering about, is when we're looking at urban farming, typically this is kind of moving away from what we would traditionally know as agricultural land and farming in different areas. How do you get that right with understanding the fact that it's completely different soil more often than not in urban areas than it is on agricultural land?
You know, it is difficult to reconcile, because so often we think farming is this massive, large tract of land with one kind of vegetable or one kind of crop. And that monoculture is an old-fashioned way of doing things. So often we're finding that a diverse range of fresh vegetables can be grown in a really small space, still using really valuable soil. But that's when fertility really comes in. We've got to build our soils by not using chemicals and not using pesticides, which create an imbalance in our ecosystem. If we work with nature, we can grow and build amazing urban farms. I mean, there's a lot of technology that is coming in terms of vertical growing and hydroponics, but that's not specifically what we're doing at Southgate Mall. What we're doing there is using and utilizing spaces in urban environments that are previous dumping grounds, spots that people don't really want to do anything else with. And it's incredible what you can do when you use agroecology principles by composting and bringing in bioorganic matter, by building that soil up and allowing nature to take its course, replenishing those soils and adding nutrients through using culminating lots and different kinds of bioorganic materials like comfrey and soil activators.
Robin, you mentioned the Southgate project, or the food garden project you guys are busy with there, and I want to look at projects like that in a bit more detail. How do those kinds of projects bring communities together and create sort of ecosystems for themselves to be sustainable, but also to add back to not just those that are servicing the projects, but actually feeding the communities around that area?
It's such an amazing question, because what's so beautiful about a lot of these projects is that there's collective ownership and each one is different. But what's important is that sort of collaboration is fostered by Food and Trees for Africa as an NGO, but by multiple corporations and CSI donors who also want to build a more resilient food system. So in this particular case, Boipihlelo Co-op was in existence and they were looking for places to grow food. They were looking for expansion possibilities, and that's when it became so perfect that they would start their production and expand their production for primarily, at the moment, we're looking at cash crops like spinach and spring onions and coriander, because making an income, however small that is initially, ensures that it is a sustainable project. And so Food and Trees for Africa is maintaining the garden with the support of our donor, which is Southgate Mall, ensuring that the project members themselves have taken on all of the labor themselves. They are taking full ownership of this project. And it's only through these strong community bonds that these sorts of projects flourish.
The project is called the Boipihlelo Food and Security Primary Cooperative. And I want to look at that second aspect of it, Robin, around security. I had a conversation a little while ago around the importance of food security, and obviously understanding that we live in a very different world now with increasing rates of food insecurity. In fact, there's been studies that suggest that one in every four children is susceptible to food insecurity, and that presents a very real existential threat to communities and to individuals. Can we sustainably solve problems like food insecurity or food security through urban farming?
I think it's one of the solutions, Jimmy. And the solutions come in with a huge amount of planning in terms of production. You know, climate change is changing our weather. It means that our rainfall is not as predictable. And sometimes when rain does come, it comes in huge amounts. And then we have flooding. Then we have erosion problems. So I think the key is that all of us as actors, as implementers, as agents of change, need to understand that it takes personal responsibility and corporate responsibility to ensure that we can have a diverse range of food suppliers, whether it's fresh vegetables that are at gate sales to communities, which is what we saw during COVID, at market gardens exploded during COVID because suddenly people needed food on their doorsteps. They couldn't line up for miles and miles at different malls because they couldn't get in to retailers. Suddenly people became more aware of what community bonds they had, what access they had to fresh fruit and vegetables and herbs. And in terms of contributing to a food secure South Africa, I think the best way that we can do that is by collaborating and by identifying what all of those solutions look like. In terms of market gardens and small farm networks and aggregating, you know, smaller solutions and local solutions, that's one of the ways. But also at a policy level, you know, making sure that we don't import seed or chemicals that are going to be destructive to our environment and further degrade our soils. That's just a short-term solution to something that, if we don't work with nature in a long-term planning away, we're not going to solve the solution. We're not going to get ahead of the rising tide of insecurity in terms of and food production in the world.
Robin, how do we get involved with initiatives like this? I mean, I know that you, as Food for Africa and the NPO, deal with a lot of these sorts of challenges where you can, but you obviously do need some additional support to ensure that these initiatives are sustainable and that you're able to continue to do the work that you do. How do people get involved with Food and Trees for Africa if they're looking to contribute towards this urban farming and towards food security?
I think as individuals in marginalized communities, getting involved in your local market garden or school-based food garden is the best way that you can help your community and help yourself in terms of skills development and food production. Learning about looking after your soil, about planting trees and understanding climate resilience is one of the best ways that you as an individual in a marginalized community can look after yourself. But as a CSI implementer, I think a lot of corporates are getting involved. We've got our beautiful website, which is trees.org.za, and anyone can pop on there. They can apply as farmers, they can apply to our programs, and we will help them with support in the form of mentorship and infrastructure, things like shade cloth structures and water tanks and irrigation, which just makes farming that much easier. And for donors, they can also get involved with us by simply emailing info@trees.org.za, and we'll get back to them in terms of partnerships.
There you have it, folks. There's a lot that you can do to contribute towards food security and towards sustainable farming. I think we'll leave it at that. Robin, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Robin Heels, who's the head of programs at Food and Trees for Africa, joining us to take a look at urban farming and how it can be a positive for communities. It's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hurst is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.